Today, we're bringing you an update to our Freshwater series about five men sentenced to 104 years in prison 10 years ago after being found guilty of conspiring to import £53 million worth of cocaine into the UK. In five episodes, we interrogated their case. If you haven't heard the series, do go back now and listen from the start. This episode is all about their hearing at the Court of Appeal and the decision that followed. Just beside the Royal Courts of Justice is a church. Every hour or so, the bells ring. I don't know who decided to put the court building right next to this church, but whoever it was had a sense of drama. A few hundred yards down from the church, me and my producer Josh walk under this huge stone archway through some gigantic old wooden doors. We go through security, where we have to hand in our microphone. We walk into the main hall, and it honestly looks more like a cathedral than a court building. The floor is a beautiful marble mosaic. There are stained glass windows and 80 feet high ceilings with Gothic arches. Serious looking judges from history look down at us from oil paintings. There are miles and miles of narrow wooden corridors shooting off in all directions. We go down one of them, up some stairs, around a few corners, through a few more doorways, and eventually we arrive at courtroom four. The families are there, in the public gallery, waiting for the fate of their fathers, brothers, and husbands to be decided. The usher says, "All rise." Three judges appear from behind a red curtain wearing their wigs and gowns. They walk past bookshelves full of red leather-bound books and sit down in red leather chairs. And the appeal of the Freshwater Five begins. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, Freshwater Part 6, The Decision. So, I've got to be honest, the first couple of days of the hearing wasn't the riveting courtroom drama I was hoping it might be. The hearing was scheduled to last for 4 days, and it was split in half. The first half, days 1 and 2, were set aside for expert evidence. The second half, days 3 and 4, was for submissions, which basically means the part where the barristers argue with each other about the evidence and about the law. So the first half, the expert evidence, I'm not going to go into that in huge detail right now. I'll tell you about the key bits later when they become relevant. For now, let me just say, it was complicated. Really complicated. I actually can't convey to you just how complicated it was. Five experts, some of them marine navigational experts, some of them engineers, were cross-examined by both the defence and prosecution barrister for 2 whole days. All of those experts are independent, with a responsibility to the court, and they can disagree without it meaning that one is right and one is wrong. So there were long discussions about how radar technology works, about how the AIS system works, and the margins of error in the two competing sets of navigational data. When I look through my notes, some of the words on the page include reliable zero baseline, azimuth determinations, and mean variation tending to zero in the average. At one point, there was a heated argument about the curvature of the Earth and how that played into things. So as much as I know you'd like me to give you the full breakdown of that, I'm going to set it to one side for now. We're going to pick up the story on day 3 of the hearing, when the action really started, when the lawyers took all of the expert evidence and try to make sense of it. When we arrive outside the Royal Courts of Justice on day three, the families of the Freshwater Five are already there, as are Danny Payne and Scott Birtwistle, the two men who are no longer in prison. The mood seems really positive. Between them all, they have five massive orange buoys attached to some white fishing rope. On each buoy is written a single word in a black marker. Somebody from Appeal is rearranging the family members, shuffling them around, trying to get the buoys in the right order. Eventually, it reads, "Justice for the Freshwater Five." They walk across the zebra crossing in front of the court building, Abbey Road style, holding up their message. A truck drives past and a guy looks at the boys, rolls down his window and shouts, "Freedom!" After they've had a few photos taken, Sue and Maisie Beer come over to see us.
Possibly one of the weirdest things I've done for, well, maybe about a week, to be fair. I work in a primary school. But yeah, it's really nice to be able to see each other and, you know, that moral support for each other, isn't it?
And Sue and Maisie are the wife and daughter of John Beer, the scaffolder who picked up Zoran from the ferry terminal. The one who the prosecution said was the liaison between the fishermen and the organised crime group. John is bringing this appeal with Danny Payne. Although, as we've said before, if their appeal succeeds, then in practice, all of the men should have their convictions overturned.
Did you sleep last night?
I listened to God knows how many podcasts to try and meditate and get off to, you know, dream this and sleep this. Podcast, but I was awake from about 3:30.
What about you, Maisie?
Me and mum are both like completely opposite. Mum gets to sleep but then wakes up in the middle of the night. I just can't get to sleep to begin with, but then once I've fallen asleep, I think it's a bit of a pain for you to actually try and get me up, isn't it? But no, just yeah.
What's it like watching the arguments in there?
Well, it kind of feels like we're watching a film or something. Like, it doesn't feel real. And, like, even, like, some bits you don't understand and we're kind of, like, looking round at everyone else in the court, like, trying to see their reactions. But they just have such good poker faces. Like, you're sat there trying to work out whether that was a good thing that just happened, a bad thing. It's so hard to try and figure out what's going on.
We don't know. They're not giving anything away. Obviously, understandably so, but you're just desperate for something, you know. Oh God, yeah, that was great. Couple of times sort of look across at each other and we're all sort of smiling at each other thinking, was that a good thing?
When this began, Maisie was just 7. She didn't go to the original trial, but the case has been the backdrop to most of her life. That's been horrible, but she's also found something inspiring in it. Emily Bolton, who you'll remember, the men's investigator come solicitor and the director of Appeal.
Where I want to be like Emily and everyone at Appeal, that is what I want to do with my life after seeing all the great stuff that they've done, not just for us, but the other families and the other like people that they support. So it's really interesting for me to actually see it in practice rather than just sitting in a classroom learning about it. It might not happen. I might never get the day where I can actually practice law, but I'm still so interested in it. And obviously, again, you've got to hope for the best, but perhaps when I
you're going to go out and grab the world and shake it up, I think, after everything you've been through.
But the thing is that I'd love to do it, but when Dad comes home, I might decide, you know what, I don't want to go off to uni anymore. I might decide I just want to find something to train in at home, but law is my dream. I would love to become an Emily or someone from Appeal. Like, they're just, it can't not put a smile on your face. You have to be grateful for them, especially because they're a charity and they do it because they believe in people, and I'd love to be able to help other people out just because they, like, I believe in them. I believe that they didn't do what they've been convicted of. I think it would be an amazing thing to do.
Then we spoke to Danny Payne, the other man bringing the appeal alongside John. Later, he would run back to his hotel and change into a suit. But as we spoke to him, he was wearing Converse, a leather jacket and a black and white polka dot bandana.
How are you feeling right now? You're outside this historic building and they're going to decide your fate.
I'm not really sure. Obviously, it's just anticipation and hoping, praying that it all comes right. But also got that sort of, you can't build yourself up too much in case you get knocked down. Because that's the trouble with the podcast and things like that. I go to work the next day. Oh, I heard you on the radio. Oh, you're going home. You're going to get acquitted. And people keep saying that. Then you believe it. And then this is kind of like prison. You can shut things off. You just kind of put it in a box for now. Or I do. Otherwise, I wouldn't be sleeping. I wouldn't be eating. So if I try and entertain it too much, then it does. It just becomes, and it's just all become so real in the last day or two. It's daunting. It really is daunting.
This is a thing that I picked up from most of the family members. Yes, a sense of hope, but also not really allowing themselves to hope too much. Just before they all headed into court, I asked Sue and Maisie what they would do if John gets released from prison.
Oh, I don't know. I really don't know.
It's something that's hard to think about because I think when you think about it, it's like, oh, if it doesn't happen now, then it's going to be devastating. But I know, like, my uncle could go up and pick him up, and then we'll just be like walking down the street and be like, oh, hi, Dad. And because of COVID, we haven't been able to see him. Well, you last saw him in February, and I didn't see him. The last time I saw him was in January. So the last time we were actually able to give him a proper hug was more than a year ago.
Do you feel happy at the moment?
I feel happy that we finally got here, but it's kind of like you have to hope and pray for the best, but prepare yourself for the worst, because anything could happen at any time. It could all go wrong still. Obviously, we don't want it to go wrong, but you have to think about the worst thing.
So like we said earlier, we've had that massive kick in the stomach once already. All of us have. And as you know, you kind of, that having that feeling back is going to be the worst thing ever. I'm really confident we won't get that feeling back, but you have to be prepared for it. Yeah, so, you know, bring it on.
Let's bring it on. We're ready for the battle now, aren't we?
So in we go, back through the Great Hall, through the maze of corridors, and back into the courtroom. I sit with the families up in the balcony. There's a skylight above us. The sun beams through the glass and shows up how dusty the wooden panels around the room are. There's a black metal cage on one side of the room, which is presumably for appellants who are still in prison. It's empty today. I'm guessing John Beer would have been in the cage if he wasn't being live-streamed into the room for COVID reasons. The barristers are sitting at benches on either side of the courtroom. Technically, they are the appellant barrister and the respondent barrister. But for simplicity, I'm going to call the one representing the men the defence barrister and the other the prosecution. So, the defence barrister is on the left-hand side and the prosecution barrister is on the right. Scattered around the desks are maps and admiralty charts and huge folders filled with documents. The judges come in and the battle, as Sue described it, begins. The defence barrister stands up and begins to make the first submissions to the court on behalf of the Freshwater Five. There are four grounds for this appeal. We told you a little bit about them in episode 4, but I'm going to go into more detail now. Even though there are four grounds, they are sort of thematically split into two groups. The defence barrister tells the judges that for the men to be convicted back in 2011, the jury must have been sure of two things. First, that their boat, the Galwad, picked up the drugs. Two of the grounds of appeal are saying that could never have happened. Second, that the Galwad deposited those drugs in Freshwater Bay around 17 hours later. And the other two grounds are saying that couldn't have happened either. The defence barrister begins with the first group, that the Galwad couldn't have picked up the drugs in the first place. The main argument here, ground one, is the stuff we talked about back in episode 4, the idea that the two boats, the Galwad and the container ship, the Oriane, never actually came close enough together for the handover to take place, that their two tracks never crossed. You'll remember that at the original trial, the two sides did not dispute the routes that the two boats took that night. They relied on data. For the Galwad, they used its Olex machine, the little fishing computer, and for the Oriane, they used its AIS system. There was a chart plotting the data that showed that the two tracks crossed and that the Galwad slowed down. And the theory, on which the jury convicted the men, was that this was when the drugs were thrown overboard and picked up by the fishermen. We also told you that Emily Bolton came to the case and found a new, alternative version of where the Oriane was. The radar data from a UK BA surveillance boat involved in the operation, the Vigilant. And that the radar version showed the Oriane further south than was presented at trial, so that the tracks of the two boats never came close, no closer than 165 metres. And if that was correct, the handover could not have happened. And we predicted in episode 4 that what would happen in this hearing would be a contest between these two bits of data, the AIS and the radar. And therefore an argument about whether or not the two boats ever came close enough together for the drugs to be picked up. We called it a data navigational arm wrestle. Well, that arm wrestle was now taking place. This may be an obvious thing to say, but the two sources of data, AIS and radar, are mutually exclusive. We explained in episode 4 how the defence team would argue in favour of radar, and that is exactly what they did. And then the prosecution responded, and to me, there were two key arguments. The first was actually based on direct evidence, evidence from Jamie Green himself. The prosecution barrister argued that 10 years ago, at the original trial, Jamie seemed to side with the AIS through his own words. He actually described manoeuvring around the Oriane. The defence barrister said that this needed to be understood in context. He said Jamie wasn't recounting his actual memories. He said that at trial, Jamie was presented with two experts, one called by the prosecution and one by the defence, who both agreed that the boats must have crossed path. So Jamie assumed it was true. The barrister implied that to disagree would have looked stupid. Then there was the other critical prosecution argument, based on evidence from an expert who argued that the radar had something called a bearing error of 0.9 degrees, and that this could possibly be caused by problems with the Vigilant's gyro compass. My oversimplification of that is basically that the radar equipment on the Vigilant wasn't quite pointing in the right direction, and that skewed the result by a certain amount. And the prosecution expert said, if you correct that 0.9 bearing error, then all of a sudden, the AIS data and the radar data are no longer dramatically different. They kind of match up. And all of a sudden, both sources of data show that the two boats do come close together after all. I should say a defence expert disagreed with that interpretation of the data quite strongly. And ultimately, the defence barrister said, we prefer radar, you prefer AIS. It's possible they're both wrong. Ultimately, we're 10 years down the line trying to carry out an exercise in what he called navigational archaeology. We're trying our best to have an argument now that should have been had in front of a jury 10 years ago. And the reason we couldn't have that argument is because this radar data existed and we weren't told about it. The fact that this dispute exists now at all and that credible experts are disagreeing about it, that should be enough. So that's ground one, the big one, that they hoped would show that the drugs could never have been picked up.
No, they said to them, can you give us a bit of time off?
In the middle of proceedings, the families hung around outside the court, eating lunch and analysing what had been happening inside. And there was one thing I picked up from quite a few family members and men that I spoke to. Some of them said it more explicitly than others. But to me, it was like there was generally a bit of a feeling that what was happening in court was not something they were doing, but rather something that was happening to them. Their fates and the fates of their families were being decided by wigged judges, listening to wigged barristers, arguing over things like margins of error, while they watched from the sidelines. That might be partially to do with just how complicated the arguments were, but I think it went deeper than that.
It's legal arguments and things that are so technical that you don't know when they're going on about the cosine of the signal from the radar. Sorry, and if the boat turns like this, then the sound, the signal's going to... You just... gyroscopic compasses, stuff like that. So you're kind of lost in it unless you're an expert on it.
Do you want to scream out sometimes?
Yeah, you want to sometimes. They said something in there the other day and I just wanted to say, whoa, hang on. It's not like that, it's like this. But you can't. The last time I was in court was 9.5 years ago and then I didn't come out for another 8. Yeah, it's just the whole process. It's like PTSD, isn't it? It's like, whoa, it's that same thing again.
Back inside the courtroom, the conversation moved to the other half of the appeal. Not about the handover of drugs out at sea, but the argument that the fishermen couldn't have dropped the drugs off either. We cover the defence's arguments about this in quite a lot of detail in episode 4, so I'll just summarise. You might remember that when Emily uncovered the new radar data, it didn't just show what was going on in the middle of the English Channel. It also showed what was going on around 17 hours later in Freshwater Bay. And they argued that the data revealed two key things. First, an unidentified boat speeding towards the place where the drugs were later found, less than an hour after the Galwad had been there. As a matter of logic, this is either a police boat or not a police boat. If it was a police boat, then that suggests they went to look to check out if the drugs were there. And they weren't, because the drugs weren't found until the next morning. And if it was not a police boat, then surely it should have been considered as an alternative suspect. The second point was what looked like a police surveillance plane that appeared to fly over Freshwater Bay, where the drugs were found, just minutes after they were said to have been thrown into the water. Again, if that happened and the men had just thrown the drugs into the bay, why did they not see them there? On the question of the boat, the prosecution barrister said there is no evidence that this was a police boat. And as for it being a potential alternative suspect, she argued that this possibility was already open to the jury at the original trial. She said the jury were aware that the two clifftop officers left the bay at 7 p.m. and from then on, the bay was not being watched. So in essence, she was saying, this second boat doesn't really change anything. But on the question of the plane, something really interesting happened. The prosecution barrister seemed to acknowledge that it could have been a surveillance plane. In fact, when asked if the court should proceed as if the UKBA plane may have flown over Freshwater Bay at that time, she said, it is safest to proceed on that basis. But then she argued, if that did happen, nothing was seen. Maybe because they couldn't see. Or maybe they did see something but didn't realise its significance. Maybe it's because nobody was looking. The defence barrister responded by saying that that was not credible, that the three-man crew of a surveillance plane involved in a drugs operation would not spot the drugs, especially when they were tied together with a bright white floating rope and attached to a red buoy, especially when it was flying at a pretty low height. But the prosecution barrister also said this: the reality of the situation is that this single piece of evidence cannot significantly undermine the rest of the case. In other words, even if you're right about this, the rest of the case against the men at trial, Austin and Dujic, the burner phones, the drugs being found in the bay where the Galwad had been, all of this is so strong that this little extra challenge doesn't make the conviction unsafe. So that's a summary of the key points. I have to say, having read so deeply into this case, I felt really quite emotional sitting there watching it play out, watching the legalistic spying over people's lives. If I felt like that, I can hardly imagine what the families must have been going through. To be honest, at this point, Josh and I didn't feel that positive about the men's chances. As Maisie Beer said, appeal court judges don't give much away. But from what I could see, at least one of them didn't seem at all convinced by a really key argument: the idea that the radar data suggested the boat's tracks didn't cross. But there is one other really significant thing I want to throw into the mix that relates to all of the grounds. Towards the end of the proceedings, the submissions turned to the issue of disclosure. That is, whether or not the defence should have had access to all of this radar data 10 years ago, at the time of the trial. The radar data that was now allowing them to have all these new arguments about where the Oriane was that night and about the surveillance plane and the second boat. And this seemed, to me at least, to be the one moment of the hearing that went most clearly in favour of the men. The prosecution barrister said, "It is plainly correct that it is no fault of the applicant that this was not available at trial or during the investigation." And then she made this concession: "I accept that it should have been." At this point, I was sitting up in the heavens with the families in the public gallery, and a wave of excitement seemed to pass through them. They all looked at each other and made eye contact with one another across the room. Some of them smiled. Maisie Beer was whispering to her mum, Sue. Scott Birtwistle twisted around and tried to catch the eyes of Jamie Green's daughters. They all seemed a little bit shocked and excited that the prosecution had conceded this. The prosecution barrister said, "In my submission, there is no bad faith on the part of the investigation. There was a failure in communication between one of the experts and the investigators." And then one of the judges replied with this: "This is an extraordinary thing for the prosecution to do. Find potentially important primary evidence and do nothing." At that point, the excitement grew. The judge seemed, intentionally or not, to be echoing the words of the judge at the original trial, who described the amended clifftop evidence of the police officers as extraordinary. That was a high point for the families. A little explosion of something they could grab onto and say, that was good for us. But then things settled down into a more familiar rhythm of complicated legal argument. The two barristers made their final points. The prosecution barrister argued that the conviction was safe because the weight of evidence against the men at trial was so strong, and none of the new grounds came close to making the jury's decision unsafe. The final words went to the defence barrister, who said, "I'm making arguments now that you would make to a jury. Why? Because these are issues you would argue at trial, and which couldn't be argued because of a major disclosure failure. The court cannot know what a jury hearing all the evidence would have concluded. What a jury might have made of all of this could have been very different had disclosure taken place." Both of the barristers were now sitting down, and the time had come. I guess I was expecting a spectacular moment where the judges said something profound and gave their decision and their reasons. But what happened was the opposite: extremely underwhelming and very quick. One of them simply said, "You won't be surprised to hear that we have reserved judgment." In other words, he was saying, we need more time to make up our minds. He then told everyone that this is a complex case and it might take a while. Then it was all rise again and the hearing was over. The culmination of 10 years of fighting and waiting. Now it was time to wait some more. The families walk out of the public gallery. I can't figure out, just from looking at their faces, whether they are happy or sad about the judgment being reserved. More than anything, they look exhausted. Outside the court, there are some reporters gathered around, and Emily reads a statement.
So we've just come to the end of 4 days of hearings in the case of the Freshwater Five, and the court has decided to reserve judgment. What that means is they're going to go away and read what's been submitted and think about what they've heard, and then issue a judgment at some time in the coming weeks. We don't think it'll be months, we think it'll be more likely to be weeks, because the court is obviously aware that the case has been around for a very long time. The court's been listening to evidence now from experts and also submissions from counsel, and it's now in the hands of the court what to do. Now, all this week in London, the families of the Freshwater Five have been here, once again walking into a courtroom and asking for justice. And they've Sue Beer, who's the wife of John Beer, one of the Freshwater Five, has got a short statement that she'd like to read to you. Then we'll take a couple of questions, and then everyone, I'm afraid, is exhausted and we need to go home. Sue.
Thank you. This is an anxious day for our men and our families as we await the judgment. Our men and our families have been the victims of a heinous miscarriage of justice. To be wrongly imprisoned for 10 years for a crime they didn't commit should be something that never happens in a modern society and exposes a deep and serious flaw in the legal system. We hope the Court of Appeal now has everything it needs to finally see the truth, that the men are innocent and should never have been convicted of this crime. We hope beyond hope that they will set right the wrong that has been done to us and overturn these convictions.
The reporters disperse and the families sort of mill around for a bit on the pavement in front of the court building. A few of them sit on the floor, some light cigarettes, family members hug each other. They all look really knackered. We go over to see Jamie Green's daughter Maisie and his sister Nikki.
I think we all need to go home and digest what we've heard and seen this week, and probably we'll have a better view of it when it's all sunk in a little bit, to be fair. I mean, there's been high points, there's been low points. And, you know, we've got to go home, think about what's been said and sit and wait for the verdict, which is going to be really, really tough.
That it's sort of out of our hands now. You know, that sort of weight off your shoulders is, it's waiting for the decision now. Everything that can be done has been done, and it's just a time to wait, unfortunately, hopefully not too long.
We go over to see the family's lawyer, Emily Bolton.
I think at the moment all I feel is tiredness. It has always been a roller coaster, this case, and the hardest thing is always having to tell the families and the prisoners that they're going to have to wait some more, and I really, really hope that the next thing we tell them is that they don't have to wait any longer, because all the difference between winning or losing now means, is it going to be over, or are we going to have to keep fighting?
Coming up, the Court of Appeal makes its decision. Time passes by. A week, then another week, then another. We contact the families now and then. They're all really struggling with the weight of the uncertainty. Although Nikki and Sue both tell us that if there's one thing they have gotten used to over the years, it's waiting. All we know is that the day before the judgment is handed down, a little message will pop up on the Court of Appeal's website. So me and Josh get into the habit of refreshing it at the same time every day. Then, last week, on Wednesday afternoon, just over a month after the appeal began, something happens. The case is listed. We'll find out the result the following morning at 10:30 a.m. You'd think maybe that the men and the families would know something before us, but apparently not. Here's Sue.
So, had a message saying that the judgment was going to be handed down at 10:30 yesterday morning, and that John and Danny would be informed an hour beforehand. So John didn't know, because obviously he's in the prison, so he wasn't aware. So when he rang me, it was kind of like, it was massive tears, massive excitement, massive anxiety, I think. And then almost like planning for what we were going to do when we went to pick him up. And I think we kind of got a little bit carried away of ourselves, which is what we did 10 years ago, before the night before the conviction, before they were found guilty, because it all seemed so positive that night. You know, the day at the end of court that day, we all went home very positive. And, you know, I think we kind of ran away of ourselves. And I feel like I should have protected us all more from that, from the knock that we've got. We weren't expecting it.
Do you want to tell me about the morning?
It was a very sleepless night, Wednesday night, trying to work out, you know, oh God, as soon as we get that call from them to say, yeah, he's free, the appeal's been upheld, go and pick him up, working out in my head logistics, what it was going to feel like, what it was going to look like, who, you know, what are we going to do when we get home and stuff like that. Then when we got the phone call, me and the two kids, like, put it on loudspeaker, and it was Johnny just said, it's no good, it's a no. And we all just looked at each other and went, no, come on, stop mucking about. And he went, why would I joke about this? They've just said no. They've said there's the compelling evidence to uphold the, even though it's all circumstantial, there's compelling evidence to uphold the conviction. The kids just went off in opposite directions, cried, tears. I was just trying to, I didn't know what to say, because I didn't believe him. And now I'm just boiling with anger and fury and just disbelief.
How was Maisie?
She, bless her, she is trying to find, the way that our family are, all try to be very positive. Maisie's trying to be very positive because she was looking at, you know, maybe we can go to the Supreme Court, maybe we can do this, and maybe we can speak to Emily about that. But it's all, you know, they're devastated. All three of the kids are devastated.
This sense that I talked about earlier from both Sue and Danny Payne, of hoping, but at the same time trying not to allow themselves to hope too much, not to get carried away. Well, it sounds like Sue tried, but didn't quite manage. She did get her hopes up. And when I spoke to Danny, it seemed like he was the same.
I was at work. And I phoned my mum and dad. And then it was on lunch break, tea break this morning, and I was supposed to go back to work. And I just stayed in my truck, turned around and went home. And then I actually went back to work 2 hours later, but. Yeah, I just couldn't deal with it right then. It was like, do you know what? I just don't want to be here. Obviously, we've spoke many times, and I do try and put a brave face on it and say, look, it doesn't bother me that much. I'm still outside, still get to see my mum and dad, and, you know. But yeah, it does. I just gave myself hope, and I almost feel stupid for giving myself hope that it could be, you know, work out right. So, yeah, just pissed off myself a little bit for allowing myself to be kind of hurt again by it.
You saw 4 days of, you were there obviously for the whole thing. How did you feel it had gone?
Honestly, I thought we kind of won. I mean, you were there the last day, weren't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you were in the court with me. There was just things that, like, they admitted that they failed to disclose something. Well, if you fail to disclose something, surely that's enough to discount it. There's rules for a reason, not, you know, can't just say, well, yeah, do you know what? We didn't do that, but because of everything else, it still stands.
Well, actually, it seems you can. That's pretty much exactly what the court did. The decision was 51 pages long, so this is going to have to be a very potted version, but I'll do my best to summarise it for you. The thing that the judges seemed keenest to stress is that the original case at trial against the men was very strong. The judgment runs through the evidence against the men, much of what we discussed in episode 2 of the series. Zoran coming to the Isle of Wight with Austin and Dujic. The calls to and from the burner phones, both from the men at sea and from John Beer on land. The Galwad and the Oriane coming close together. The clifftop officers citing something being thrown into Freshwater Bay. The lies being told by some of the men at interview. So then the question is, does this new evidence change any of that? The judgment deals with the issue of disclosure. Although I must say, it's pretty brief on this. They say they're dealing with it briefly because the prosecution conceded the point during the hearing. And because, they add, there is no basis for any suggestion of a deliberate attempt to suppress or withhold evidence. But they say they want to include it so that, and I quote, it can be clearly stated by the court, not just by counsel's concession, that what happened should not have happened. A few paragraphs later, it says that one of the prosecution's expert witnesses, the one who had the floppy disks in his safe, had made a serious and surprising mistake in not bringing the evidence forward. And although it was an honest mistake, they found that the investigation team itself was at fault for not following up to get hold of that data too, and for not joining up the investigative dots. But despite all of that, the judgment then basically, over the course of 30 or so pages, explains why none of that matters in this case, or at least how it doesn't make any difference to the jury's original verdict. I can make this pretty short by saying that the judges seem to agree pretty much with everything I've already told you that the prosecution barrister said in the hearing. On ground one, the AIS data won the navigational arm wrestle. The judges agreed that the radar data seemed to have an error on it, and that the tracks of the Oriane and Galwad did cross after all. If anything, they said the new picture painted at the appeal might even be worse for the men. And they thought it was significant that Jamie Green at the original trial didn't object to the idea that he came close to the Oriane, and they concluded that his testimony was his actual memory of events. On the other part of the defence's case, the unidentified second boat and the surveillance plane, it was the same story. There's no evidence that the second boat was a police boat, they agreed. And as for the idea it might have been an alternative suspect, they said the argument that the drugs might have been dropped off by another vessel was already explored in the original trial and must have been rejected by the jury. The defence's argument that this was actual evidence of a second boat in the area, rather than theoretical speculation that one might have been there at some point, didn't seem to have much impact. And on the surveillance plane, surprisingly to me at least, they seemed equally unconvinced. As I told you, the prosecution barrister herself said at one point it was safest to proceed on the basis that the aircraft over Freshwater Bay could indeed be a surveillance plane used by the police. But despite that, the judges seemed to reject the idea and said instead, the court finds no reason to doubt the log completed at the time by those on board the aircraft and disclosed at trial. There is nothing in the log to suggest that the aircraft flew over Freshwater Bay. And they said, in any case, even if this is a police plane, we agree with the prosecution barrister. A failure to see the drugs is not surprising. A few paragraphs later, they make their final conclusion for the whole case, which is this. Standing back and looking at all the evidence available at trial, as well as the evidence now available, while the evidence is circumstantial, this was a compelling prosecution case of conspiracy to import cocaine. The grounds of appeal do not begin individually or collectively to cast doubt on the safety of these applicants' convictions. The applications for leave to appeal conviction are accordingly refused. We asked the Crown Prosecution Service for an interview to go through the judgment and also to ask some questions about issues we had raised in earlier episodes. But again, they declined to talk to us. They did give us a statement which simply reads, "We welcome the decision of the court that the convictions are safe." Those convictions are for a conspiracy to import £53 million worth of drugs into the UK. A crime which former DCI Lee Davis stressed to us in an earlier episode is not victimless. That is a lot of cocaine. But the defence solicitor, Emily Bolton, remains convinced that the men she represents are innocent. How are you feeling?
I am feeling deflated. I'm feeling angry and I'm feeling incredulous. I'm particularly disturbed by the terms of the judgment. We presented four very specific new pieces of information that the jury who convicted these men were entitled to see. They did not see them because, as the court has admitted, they were withheld. But the court has decided that they wouldn't have made any difference to the jury.
The thing that seemed to bother Emily the most was the Court of Appeal judge's take on the thing I've just told you about, the surveillance plane. You said you were angry. Why?
Because the court hasn't listened. The court said, are you saying this is not your aircraft? It might be or it is. And she said, it is safest to presume that it is. And this was her conceding that the radar evidence, that's evidence from a computer, not a human, showed that there was an aircraft in the area at that time, behaving like a surveillance aircraft. And in this judgment, the court conclude that that is inarguable, that that aircraft was there at that time. And instead of recognising the radar data, instead of recognising the concession by prosecuting counsel, they refer back to a log that was submitted at trial by the aircraft camera operator, which says that the plane took off at 1900 hours, which of course, you know, cannot be the case if it is simultaneously over Freshwater Bay 2 minutes later. And I think the frustrating thing here is that, you know, obviously what the court is saying to us is you haven't presented enough evidence. But as we've already discussed in relation to how the system works, we can't be allowed to see the evidence that would enable you to present enough evidence. You read the final paragraph of this judgment, they're essentially saying, yeah, there was a disclosure failure, but in a case where the evidence is this compelling, it's not significant. But I think, you know, anybody who's followed this case sees that actually the case against the men is not compelling and that this evidence is potentially significant.
Do you accept the court's decision?
I think the court's decision is wrong. And I think the court's decision has overlooked compelling evidence of actual innocence. And for that reason, it's deeply troubling.
There wasn't much about this judgment that Emily liked, and that's probably not massively surprising. There is one more thing I want to tell you. It's about the clifftop evidence, the stuff we've talked about at length in episode 3, where a police log that had said 6 to 7 items were thrown overboard was amended to say 10 to 12 and to match the exact description of the drugs. This was argued over at the original trial, with the judge expressing some surprise, but leaving the jury to draw its own conclusion on the veracity of the evidence. The Court of Appeal judgment says the officers embellish the log. As a result, the judges concluded there was no credible eyewitness evidence linking the men to the drugs. They appear to be suggesting that the whole case is a circumstantial one. One thing I've been struck by in all of this is how technical the legal system is and how narrow the route is to an appeal. This appeal was centred on one piece of new evidence and specific arguments that could be made around it in a very specific way. It wasn't a chance to step back and reassess the entire case, going over things that might have bothered you the first time round. It wasn't actually anything to do with the clifftop evidence or the Gatwick case or other things that the families and the men have raised, like the fact that the whole case hangs on the idea that the drugs were definitely on the Oriane, but there's never been any evidence to prove that. That's not how the system works. This has obviously been an unbelievably hard week for all the men and their families. But I think it's fair to say, particularly for the Beers. Do you know how John and Jamie are feeling about the fact that they're not coming home?
John and Jamie are both very angry. They both take it, but they're very different men and they're taking it in different ways. I think Jamie's more cynical about the situation, though John is getting that way. They are, you know, they're in a really bad place. And John, this week for John has been probably the worst of his life because his father died on Sunday. And his father had been struggling to stay alive to hear the judgment, and but finally just couldn't hang in there anymore. John was able to talk to him for about 5 minutes before he died, but that was purely serendipity. It wasn't that was, you know, beautifully arranged by the prison.
Talk to him on the phone or go
yes,
there?
Yes, talk to him on the phone. John's father hadn't been speaking for some days, hadn't been able to speak, but John was able to ask a family member to put the phone to his father's ear about 5 minutes before he died. But then that call finished. Obviously, John didn't know what was about to happen, and he was sent back to his cell. And 5 minutes later, his father died. And that was on Sunday. And then on Thursday, he got the news that his conviction was upheld by the Court of Appeal.
Maybe his dad was waiting to hear from him.
Mm. Well, I think his dad was definitely trying to hang on to hear the judgment, but I also know his dad didn't need three judges on the Court of Appeal to tell him his son was innocent. He knew it.
After all, the dust has settled. In a way, we're back to where we were before this appeal began. Scott Birtwistle and Danny Payne are still living their lives outside of prison, but on licence and under the strict supervision of their parole officers. John Beer and Jamie Green are still in prison with about 2 years left to serve. Zoran Dresic, back in Montenegro, will remain behind bars for longer. The convictions stand. In the eyes of the law, they are still guilty men, like they were before. Although in another way, their situation is now worse. They've now exhausted their direct appeals with the Court of Appeal. In this country, the Supreme Court, the highest court in the land, the one above the Court of Appeal, only deals with matters of public importance, things which affect the whole population. So that avenue seems unlikely too. The Criminal Cases Review Commission has already made its opinion pretty clear, so for anything to change, more new evidence would have to come to light. So is this the end of the road? I haven't spoken to all of the family members and men since the decision, but the ones that I spoke to, I noticed a bit of a divide. To me, it seemed like, among some of the men, maybe because this has just happened and it's still so raw, there's an increasing sense of cynicism and dejection, that maybe their convictions will always stand. Here's Danny.
Everyone just feels so beaten up today, like, do you know what? Is it worth all this shit just to be knocked back again and again and again? And I even said to Nikki Green earlier, we spoke, and I said, look, Nick, she's fuming, she's absolutely fuming. And I just said, look, you know, maybe just, you know, step back a bit. Don't let this consume your life. You know, you guys have done so much. Nice for living. And she said, well, this, you know, she said, I can't let it go. I can't.
Can you?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you have to let it go, otherwise it will just be everything. I don't want it to be everything. I don't want everything to be to do with me, to be around this.
But among Emily and the families, an anger, resilience and a desire to keep going.
And I'm actually, today, I'm actually quite cross because he seems to have accepted it. And I feel a little bit cross of everybody, John included, today, because I feel like he's just accepted that that's it. They've said no, okay, so I've got to do the rest of my time. And do you know what? I'm not accepting it. I don't know what our next steps will be, but we're not going to just sit here and say, okay, yeah, okay, we'll just, that's fine, because it's not fine. It's a massive miscarriage of justice. I mean, all the stuff that's out there to show it, there's got to be another way. We've just got to find it.
That was the final part of our Freshwater series. Thank you so much for listening, and thank you for all your amazing feedback throughout. We've enjoyed reading every tweet and every message. We've talked at length about the Clifftop evidence in this series, including in this episode, and I just want to remind you that the Independent Police Complaints Commission did carry out an investigation in which they concluded that while there were inconsistencies, the police officers had not fabricated their accounts. That's it for now. This series is produced by Josh Kelly. Sound design and original music is by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.